Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Where do you start here? I mean, look, last night I took a few hours off. I wrote about this in my newsletter. I actually tried to have a semblance of a real life last night. So I got off the internet for just a little while, came back, and as soon as you open it up, you find out that Kim Jong-un may be brain dead. I don't think that's true, but that's a story. Trump's banning all immigration. And the price of oil had dropped below zero. I mean, you want to talk about signs of the apocalypse? I mean, we're getting to the it's raining cats and dogs. Just stuff is happening now. It's like, what's next? I'm going to walk out in my backyard and there's going to be a plague of locusts or the stream is going to turn red or something. Below, look, so a barrel of oil costs less than nothing. In other words, people don't want it. They say, look, I don't want the oil. I'm willing to pay somebody to take it off my hands. And of course, then we have this tweet where the president in the middle of the night apparently decides, hey, I need to rile up my base or something like that. And he says he's going to ban all immigration, which, by the way, by definition is all legal immigration, all green cards. So as usual, this is wrapped in a fog of confusion, cynicism and contradictions. So we are turning to one of our gurus, one of our most popular favorite gurus, Stuart Stevens, who is also sitting with a front row seat to what appears to what kind of feels like the end time. So, hey, good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you? I always wanted to live in a world that oil was cheaper than hand sanitizers. So now we are.
Well, yeah, I almost feel like I want to leave my house and drive, but I thought no, because I'm getting 4 weeks to a gallon now. So it's like I've waited for this for 20 weeks and I have nowhere to go. So yeah, it's oil is cheaper than hand sanitizer. These are the times that we live in. So we could talk about some of the heavy stuff, but I want to talk about Nancy Pelosi's refrigerator first. You want to talk about that? Should we do that? Because
the sub-zero crisis.
Well, it is interesting. I love watching the memes and how fast they spread. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, particularly if you are, you know, an anti-Trump conservative and you can't defend what Trump is doing, you just sort of wait for somebody on the other side to do something that you can just jump all over. And so, correct me if I'm wrong. So Nancy Pelosi does a video in which she's eating ice cream out of her refrigerator, which is a sub-zero refrigerator. And it's like, oh my God, Nancy Pelosi has this, I don't know, you would know this, Stuart, better than me, like $20,000?
I have no idea.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's like somebody would hold a gun to my head and says, how much does that oven cost? I have no idea. So, but it's the whole thing is, see, she's privileged, she's rich, and it's everywhere, right? And, you know, thank you for tweeting out something that puts it in perspective, because I know it's a podcast. I know people can't see it, but there's this picture of Donald Trump, pre-presidential Donald Trump, in his obscenely garish penthouse apartment with Melania looking, well, like Melania, kind of fabulous, and Barron sitting on a stuffed lion, and you write, Donald Trump would like you to be upset over Nancy Pelosi's fridge.
Well, the best thing, you know, Charlie, about that photo, if you look closely, the toy cars that Barron has are two limos and a Corvette Stingray. Like, I remember growing up playing with limo cars. I mean, what parents buy their kids, like, toy limos? It's hysterical.
Well, you have to prepare them for life, right? You know?
Oh, it's just so.
Well, see, but this photo just sort of reminds me that this is Donald Trump's brand. The brand is over the top vulgarity. Yeah. It's what poor people think billionaires live like, right? So, and that is kind of the vibe that he puts out. But for the same people in Trump world, then to wax all indignant about a refrigerator, it's like the breaking of irony. If irony hadn't already been murdered 100 million times in the last 3 years, it would break.
I'm old enough, I can say that I have been on the Trump shuttle with the chintzy gold-plated bathroom fixtures on a shuttle from D.C. to New York. I mean, it was the tackiest thing I've ever seen. But, you know, in a larger sense here, Charlie, I just think the lack of political awareness about attacking Nancy Pelosi. I mean, most of my adult life, Republicans have been trying to make Nancy Pelosi an issue. And as far as I know, it's never been successful. I mean, thousands of ads have been made. I'm sure I've contributed my share. They all blend together. And it just doesn't work. You can argue why it doesn't work. You could argue it should work, but you can't argue that it has worked. And I just, you know, what it goes back to is this larger dynamic that Trump, and this is shows they're not stupid, they are desperate to make this race about anything but Donald Trump. So for a while, it was going to be socialism. So, like, that didn't work. They'll come back to it in the same way, you know, pitchers inevitably come back to the same pitches. So now they're trying to run against Nancy Pelosi. You know, if you think about it, all the time that Trump spent attacking Hunter Biden, if he had been attacking a virus, the guy would probably be unbeatable now.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd have 70% favorables.
Oh, there's no question about it. He ought to be at 70% favorables. It sort of does remind me, though, watching this, less of a strategy, less of running against Nancy Pelosi, as just the, you know, guy telling the dog, squirrel, squirrel, yeah. And they just run over here. And I kind of feel that way about the immigration thing. Okay, now I have no idea how this is actually going to work or whether he's serious about it. And I read it last night. I'm thinking, you know, by morning, this thing could disappear. By next week, we'll get stories that it's not really going into place. But look, I mean, this is one of those moments where you know that it's not really about the pandemic. This is Trump's id. Because you know that if Trump had his way, it would be all wall, all the time, all caravans, all the time, right? So, you know, putting out an executive order suspending all immigration takes the president's impulses to an untested extreme. And it's also interesting because this comes as his claque is out there going, this is exaggerated. We need to get back to work. We need to open up. It's completely safe and everything. And it's at that moment that Trump says, yes, but it's such a danger that these infected immigrants are coming in. But isn't this, I'm sorry to go on here, but it is sort of Trump wanting it both ways. You know, I'm not responsible. I'm in total control. You know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, but only I can protect you against the pandemic foreigners coming to our shores, right? And the base is going to love this.
It's the same as when in December of 2015, Trump came out for a Muslim ban. And
yeah.
To me, that is the telling moment in the whole Trump Republican Party current saga. If Reince Priebus and Republican Party were to pass this for the establishment, had come out and said, this isn't us, it's against the Constitution. If nothing else, Republicans stand for the Constitution. We can't say to Donald Trump, don't run. We can't say, don't vote for Donald Trump, but we will not support Donald Trump. If that had happened, the same way it happened when Todd Akin went out and said all this terrible stuff about rape in the 2012 Missouri Senate race, I think it would have shown that there was still some sort of soul to the Republican Party. But, I mean, to think about it, in 1980, Ronald Reagan announces in front of the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
And, you know, signs a bill making everyone who entered the country before 1983 legal. Gives his last formal speech as president as a beautiful ode to immigration. And now we've come to this. It's, you know, it mostly just makes me sad because it is so anti-American. I mean, the one country that is formed on immigration, that anybody could come to America and be an American. And Trump, it's just sad. Though I'm sure there'll be some exemption for Eastern European models in this immigration order.
Well, naturally. There must be, that was the genius exception, right?
Yes.
But I guess, you know, part of it is it's just sort of like, and by the way, you know, I mean, politicians are notorious for using a crisis to go back to their hobby horse. But the whole, why don't we just try blaming some foreigners again? I mean, because you like that. And you know, Okay, now let's go back to that Muslim ban, because you said something that was interesting, and because I really remember that so clearly. And I was still talking to Reince Priebus back then. And you may think that I'm being too nice here, but, you know, and yes, I do think in retrospect, if the Republican quote unquote establishment had stood up and said, okay, you know, you're gone. Remember all the companies that severed their ties with him, you know, after the Mexican rapists and things. I mean, there was a real sense that he was beyond the pale. One of the reasons I think that the Republican establishment didn't drop the hammer is because they didn't think they had to.
No, I agree.
They thought it would be, you know, self actualizing, that the Republican voters themselves, they had a certain still latent confidence that the voters would go, okay, well, this, we're not going on with this shit.
Well,
I mean, we're now.
Yeah, I'm more cynical about it. That I agree with you that I think that they didn't think that Trump would win. Trump has always benefited from the inability to imagine him winning. I think it greatly helped him in the primary, where everybody was just, all I need to do, these other 16 candidates, get one-on-one with Donald Trump, because clearly Republicans are not going to nominate some guy who's a failed casino owner who's, you know, been married three times and talks about dating his daughter in public. Like, Republicans aren't going to nominate that guy. I just want to be one-on-one.
Yeah.
So when I had these conversations with Republicans, and I had them all through the summer of 2016, why Republican establishment wouldn't come out more against Trump. What always came back to me was, look, Stuart, if we put our thumb on the scale, and when Trump loses, we're going to get blamed. It's not going to be because of the racism, the alt-right, the Breitbart madness. So we just have to lose and let this all wash through the system and start over. And then I would say, well, like, okay, but what if he wins? And they were like, he's not going to win. And I wasn't very good at arguing the other because, you know, I didn't think Trump was going to win. I mean, of all the people who were wrong in 2016, I really can't find anybody more wrong than me. So it just...
Well, I'm right here. But
to go back to cynicism, if you go back, you know, Trump played this, that he would run as an independent in 2015. Remember all that dance? And that,
terrified them.
So I think that it wasn't so much that they thought Republicans would come to their senses. It was, we need these Trump voters. And if we go out and take a stand and do something that might actually mean, like, we have some moral principles and the party has some sense of what it actually stands for, we might lose some voters. So, I mean, most of us don't go through life looking for moral choices.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand that, but, you know, I can understand the Munich Accord, too. It doesn't mean it's right, and doesn't mean that it doesn't have terrible repercussions.
The immigration thing, and I feel like we're going back to you know, Trump 101 here, because maybe, again, this is a sign of my naivete, that other than people like Jeff Sessions out there, I don't remember a huge pushback on the right against legal immigration. And now the distinction between legal immigration and illegal immigration seems to be almost erased. And so, because it's all about just finding some foreign entity, some foreign race to blame about this. Now, by the way, here's just a little detail that before we move on here that I think is valuable. And I put it in my newsletter this morning because I thought it was so relevant. Just a reminder that immigrants accounted for 18.2% of healthcare workers, 23% of formal and non-formal long-term care sector workers, more than a quarter, 27% of direct care workers, and immigrants account for 30.3% of nursing home housekeeping and maintenance workers. And you keep going through these numbers, this would suggest that at this moment, the immigrants are as much we rely on legal immigrants as opposed to the president of the United States deciding to make them the other that we're supposed to fear and cleanse ourselves of.
Well, I mean, another little irony is Trump tweeted his anti-immigration on an Apple device that was invented by the company of the son of a Syrian immigrant. So, you know, we just, as you said, have murdered irony. You know, to me, Charlie, what this says is that this was never about immigration. It's always been about race. And it's always been about white supremacy, a white grievance. And it's not just against African Americans. It's against, you know, he calls a judge from, a Hoosier judge from Indiana, a Mexican. It's just about a variation of hate. And the essence of Trump is hate. And so we used to say, well, I'm for legal immigration, but not illegal immigration, because then it made you look like socially acceptable, that it wasn't that you didn't like these people. And, you know, it never seems to be like Swedes that we're afraid of immigrating. It just gave you an excuse to say, I'm still a normal person. So what's happening now is Trump is doing away with that need to justify hate. And it's part of this long degradation of the public discourse and culture. And, you know, one of the principles of being conservative, I always thought, I believe this stuff, was that culture mattered more than anything. Culture was the soul of a country. I mean, all the William Bennett stuff. And we're just completely walking away from that. And we're just going to embrace white grievance to a degree that George Wallace never did.
Yeah, I have all the Bennett books here in my office, right across from my picture of Ted Cruz, just sort of to remember all of this. Let me just push back a little bit on all of this, because I used to be one of the people who would say that, yeah, we need to deal with illegal immigration, but legal immigration is the lifeblood of the country. I think Reagan really captured this part of this. And I understand that there's racial animus, but also there's a fundamental respect for the rule of law, that people should follow the rules, and that was a long and rich and good tradition, that immigration was, you know, the people coming through Ellis Island as opposed to the people sneaking across. And so when we talk about the rule of law, I think a lot of people on the right are going, wait. The rule of law also means that you don't come in illegally and you don't, you know, have fake social security cards and you don't take jobs away from people who are Americans, but also you don't jump the line of the other immigrants who have played by the rules. And I think that that's a legitimate concern, but you're right. What's happened now is this sort of just erasure of this distinction. And among the many shocking things was watching the Republican Party go from this party of immigrants and aspiration and Ronald Reagan's shining city on a hill. You know, by the way, you mentioned that final speech. I used to carry that around with me when I would debate Trumpists, and I would read what he said about immigrants. And I said, can you imagine those words being spoken by your guy, Donald Trump? And nobody had any answer for that.
No, it really goes to what is your concept of what is America? Because if America is not a country of immigrants, I really don't know what America is. It's just a place on the map with a flag. But if it's not defined by that, what is our core definition of what it is to be an American? And, you know, Trump has transformed that in many ways. When Ronald Reagan was president, to be born an American was to win life's lottery. You were the luckiest person on earth. You were privileged. To be born in America, in Trump's America, is that you're a sucker. You're a victim. These powerful forces out there like Canada are taking advantage of you. We're going to go out there and even the score and try to overcome the fact that we're these persecuted Americans. It's this victim mentality.
You know that I wrote the book. Years ago? I get the decades wrong now. It was 1992, A Nation of Victims. And mainly that culture of victimization was on the left. But it's a powerful thing.
Yeah,
that's a powerful thing to be a victim. It gives you a certain moral superiority. You're filled with resentment. It gives you an exemption from certain rules. I never imagine that the right would embrace the culture of victimization as such a core attitude as they have right now. And in order to understand Trumpism and understand how he plays to the base and understand how he gins the base up, this is the heart of it, right? They hate you. They are taking stuff away from you. You are victims. You have been screwed. You've been shafted, you know, and I'm going to defend you against all of these other people. And it runs very, very deep.
And, you know, to me, Charlie, and I have friends that think I'm crazy on this subject, but to me, it goes back to the original sin of the Republican Party, which is race. That we never, as a party, came to grips with 1964. So Eisenhower gets almost 40% of the black vote in 1956. Goldwater only gets 7% in 1964. And we never really, as a party, came to reckoning with that. And the sort of natural evolution of becoming a white party is Donald Trump. And in a country that is increasingly non-white, it's the most disturbing sign for the future. I mean, I go back to this one stat I saw, that 15 and under Americans are majority non-white. So there's some reason to believe those 15-year-olds will become 18 and remain non-white. And what that means for the Republican Party is just looking at a stage 4 lung cancer x-ray. It's just bleak. Now, parties can change. Demographics don't have to be destiny, but they are destiny if you don't change. And there's no even desire to change now. I mean, I was, you know, when I was working for Bush and all this, it wasn't like we were perfect, but we recognized, we aspired to something that was bigger than us and better than us. And it just isn't there anymore. I mean, if you go back and you read George Bush's 2000 acceptance speech, it reads like some lost document from a lost civilization.
And that was a sign, though, that he was trying, that there were Republicans who were trying to deal with that original sin of race and tried over decades to do it. And I guess this is this, and we've talked about this many times on the podcast, you know, this is something that was exposed because I thought we had moved past that, and apparently.
Well, I loved your when we spoke before, you made an analogy that we thought it was a recessive gene.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a dominant gene. I thought that was really a brilliant take on it. It really is just incredibly disturbing that, you know, if you go back to the post-2012 Republican Party, Reince Priebus commissioned this so-called autopsy, which was to his credit. It's very difficult to run an organization and be self-critical, whether or not it's, you know, the Boy Scouts or Apple. And the conclusion was obvious that we needed to expand. We needed to appeal to more non-whites. We needed to appeal to women. We needed to appeal to younger voters. But part of it was posed not just as a political mandate, but as a moral mandate, that if we were going to govern a big, confusing, loud, contradictory country, that we had to reflect those differences more. So all of that got thrown out the window and said, look, we might be able to win just by being a white party again. It's like, oh, good. We don't have to pretend anymore. That's just such a burden to wake up in the morning and have to try to act like you care about this stuff. Let's just go, man. Great. And now, you know, this is what it's about. I mean, you have the chief of staff of the White House is a birther, and the newly hired press secretary is a birther. I mean, I never worked for a campaign that would hire these people.
No, and that's part of the problem is that our, you know, the world feels like it's run by the people that you would never allow to take care of your kids. You would never hire them for your own business. None of them would be put in a position of trust. You know, you mentioned that. I was thinking about this yesterday. You know, the failure to come to grips with the issue of race. And I think that another thing that's happening right now is that we are really seeing the consequences of the anti-science emphasis.
Absolutely.
on the right. And this is another one of those horrifying things because, again, I mean, I had read much of the climate change skepticism, you know, and had read the scholarly reports, but that's not the point. It is this contempt for expertise. It is the willingness to flout actual data that you're seeing on a daily basis. I mean, watching Dinesh D'Souza go on Fox News and say, you know, yeah, this is not serious. They're overhyping it. They're lying about the death numbers and everything, attacking Dr. Fauci. And you realize, you know, yes, Dinesh D'Souza is a complete immoral grifter, but there were decades that led to this moment for someone like that to be on the air and to inspire the kind of protests we saw over the weekend.
Yeah, we've monetized stupidity, and it's become a valuable business to get into. And, you know, I just look at it. It's not just science. It's education. This whole notion that going to college is a place you go to be indoctrinated by the left. I mean, anytime any culture embraces anti-knowledge, anti-education, I mean, it's a short walk to the Khmer Rouge, or Red Guard. And I laugh about this every time I go to an Ole Miss football game and I look around and go like, this is the left indoctrination? Really? You know, you go out in the Grove after a game, it's like, oh man, I'm really surrounded by a bunch of leftists. It's just insane.
Well, see, I mean, Yeah, well, this is the problem of taking a legitimate concern and then watching it metastasize into something. So you watched the protests over the weekend.
Yes.
Which I thought were extraordinarily revealing. And look, if we had no income and you can't pay your mortgage, you're out of work and everything, I can understand that people are scared. I can understand that there are legitimate concerns. I also understand that some of the orders by the governors, you know, may feel draconian and may be legally problematic. I don't think that the legal arguments against what, you know, the governor and my state are doing, I don't think the legal challenge is trivial, but, you know, the decision to go out, you know, with these in your face, you know, flag waving, maskless, social distance defying protesters, that's a whole different thing. And also, you just saw, it had a very zombie Tea Party feel to it, you know, watching the conspiracy theorists, the folks that are, you know, again, attacking a science out there, you know, and waving the signs for freedom, it's really all about just Trump.
You know, it all ties together with this, I think, the larger theme of victimhood, because most conspiracies come from a thing that we are victims. So the Kennedy assassination conspiracies, it's that we're victims of, be it, you know, was it the mob that killed him? Was it whoever? There's always some great conspiracy here that victimizes people. So now there's this great conspiracy that involves, it's really the greatest conspiracy we've ever had, because it involves not only scientists and Dr. Fauci and all this, it involves every Western democracy. So to believe that this is some conspiracy, you have to believe that, like, the Spanish are in on it, the French are in on it, the Italians are in on it. I mean, it's a greater coalition than World War II. And it's just, you know,
cunning.
It really is the most cult-like sort of idea.
Well, and you can tell it's cult-like because of its lack of coherence and the contradiction. So the, you know, we need to fire Fauci. Fauci is terrible. Well, if Fauci is terrible, then Donald Trump is the, you know, dupe in chief, right? You know, that they can believe that Trump is the great man, the only one with the strength and the power to save America, but he's also apparently being manipulated by the deep state, right? I mean, but you can hold these ideas in your head at exactly the same moment. And that is part of the problem.
It's you know, as they said about the ancient Egyptians, they could hold contradictory beliefs in their head without it being contradictory. And you know, it just really, I think, in those moments, it's just about emotion. And anger and hate are the key in which the Trump era is played. And it's just a question of, what am I going to wake up today and be angry about? And it's leads to this sort of series of rants. So there's a bunch of people now who are paid well to be professional haters. I mean, D'Souza, Laura Ingraham, Limbaugh has always had this element of being a professional hater. It was sort of balanced by the fact that he had some self-awareness of being something of a buffoon and was also could be a funny guy. But it's just this industry now. If you look at American history, we've had the Father Coughlins. We just never elected Father Coughlin president. And this is sort of an experiment. And what happens when you legitimize hate as a valid emotion for one of the two major parties of the world's only superpower?
So tell me how you think this is playing out, because, I mean, the protests that took place over the weekend, I mean, I understand the... I'm going to get to the polls in a moment, but I understand the impulse to think that they're just sort of one-offs, that they're, you know, well, it's Alex Jones or it's, you know, five guys on Facebook. I tried to make the point in the Bulwark yesterday. Look, don't sleep on all of this. The Republican Party apparatus, business organizations, other conservative organizations that are funded by activist donors. And I think, by the way, there's still an underestimation of the role of a handful of activist conservative donors in pushing some of these groups to do the crazy. I mean, here in Wisconsin, you have, you know, Right to Life organizations who are all in on the protests, you know, the free market think tanks all in on the protest. Well, what's that about? Well, you know, again, who's pushing this agenda? So there's a huge push on the right to support these protests, but it's also true that they are not representative of public opinion. So give me your sense. You're looking at the polls. You're looking at the trend lines. Is this working? I mean, there's a poll out this morning. Yeah. There's a poll in the Washington Post showing that people still are not that, are still not that anxious to open up, and they still and a majority disapprove of the way Trump's handling it.
Well, look, with the caveat that I've been consistently wrong about predicting Trump, that little caveat. To me, I think it will be reflected upon as one of the great political miscalculations for Trump to make himself the face of mass death. This is very odd. I mean, Nixon and Johnson didn't go out every day and try to convince us how great it was that not every American was killed in Vietnam that day. You just sort of didn't want to talk about it, and you wanted to talk about solutions. And I think this began as something that they're now addicted to. And
yes.
I just think the what is it? It is Trump with bad news. There is no good news here. It's only the degree to which the news will be less bad. So,
but as the salesman, he will come out and he will show videos of how great it is. He's the king of ventilators. Everything is fine. Does reality catch up with that?
I just don't think it's reflected in the numbers that
right.
people, as you were saying, that people, you know, it's one thing to have like an opinion about something that doesn't really affect you. It's another, like, I have an opinion about this because I don't want to die. That's sort of more pressing. And, you know, it's all these people who are out there saying, look, death is a part of life and we have to do this. My sense is, okay, lead the way, man. You know, leaders lead. You go first. I just don't think that is going to carry the day. I think you can believe that Trump has tried to do a better job now. I mean, they did try to get some all this stuff, but also believe that he is incompetent ultimately and should be replaced.
Yeah.
I mean, all the Democrats have to do is just make a case that this could be better.
Okay, so there are Biden ads out there, but they appear to be online Biden ads. And so here's again, in my mind, I remember these absolutely wonderful McCain ads from 2008 going after Obama, mocking him for talking about rising seas. And, you know, a lot of us thought, well, boy, they're really taking the fight to them. Nobody saw those things.
No.
If they're not actually on television, they don't feel that they're having the impact. So give me your sense about how the air war is playing.
So this is really a big point that no one is talking about. I'm glad you brought it up. The impact of having an election that is not in the federal funding system. So just to go back to this, you know, 1976, we passed federal funding, which meant that every nominee got the same amount of money to run their general election campaign with the agreement that they would not raise or spend more money. I mean, you literally, when you walked off from your acceptance speech, there was someone there from the Treasury Department with a check. It was $80 million it started out, then it went north every 4 years as the country grew. We were always like, can you wire this money? They're like, no, we do checks. and so Obama and everybody stayed in that system. And under that system, which was intended to clean up money, but also to level the playing field, Bush lost and Carter lost. So Obama was the first candidate not to accept federal funding since Nixon and McGovern in 72, because there was no federal funding. So he ended up raising $735 million. McCain raised less than half of that. McCain took federal funding. So it meant that he had $83 million in the general election. So 2012 was the first time that two candidates were not in the federal funding system. And as someone who was involved in the Romney campaign, in June and July of 2012, the Obama campaign spent more money on television ads than Kerry and Bush spent together in their campaign. So did it matter? Well, I can only tell you it sure felt bad. And, you know, we were broke. The same way anybody who comes out of a nomination tends to be broke, except for like a Michael Bloomberg self-funder. And we had to go out and borrow $30 million. And just so, you know, not to get too in the weeds here, the way this works is you're allowed to give $2,700 maximum to a campaign. You can give for the primary and you can give for the general. So there are donors out there now who have given to Biden's general election campaign, but Biden can't spend that money. Now, you can go out potentially and borrow against that money, but you need to have to repay it once you get access to that money, which is after you get the nomination. So right now, in a non-virus world, Trump would have a tremendous financial advantage. And he would be out there, you know, just beating the crap out of Biden. So in this sense, it has really greatly played to Biden's benefit, because it has taken away that ability. It's given, it's buying them time. If you have less money, you want a shorter campaign, because at a certain point, it just averages out. You know, once you spend $10 million in a market, the idea you're going to spend 15, you don't get 50% more benefit. So this is giving Biden the time to get organized, and they ran sort of a shoestring campaign, and to raise money. They're weirdly are advantaged by the fact that they didn't raise that much money in the primary, because that means there's a pool of Democratic donors out there who can give to Biden for the first time. In the Romney campaign, we raised a ton of money in the primary, so we were kind of maxed out of donors. And we had to go out and borrow $30 million in June, I think, just to sort of stay alive. But we'd wake up every day, and every major battleground media market, we would be getting outspent at least 4-1, sometimes 4-0, because we didn't have the money to go on. So, you know, everybody says money doesn't matter as much. It's like, yeah, that's true. But I'd rather be the guy with $1 billion saying money doesn't matter than the guy trying to raise $1 billion. And it also sort of an unappreciated factor here is how much time it takes of a candidate to raise money. So, you know, having worked in the Bush campaign where we were in the federal funding system, and then having worked for Romney, it really struck me. I mean, after Bush accepted the nomination, we didn't do any fundraising. After Romney accepted the nomination, I was made a back of the envelope guess one day. I'd say we spent at least 40% of our time raising money up to November. Wow. So, I mean, it just has these great ramifications. So one of the things that's happening now is that Biden can raise money sitting at home. There's a dirty little secret in presidential campaigns that, you know, we run all over the country doing these rallies and all of this. There really is not a lot of data that suggests it matters. There's really not a lot of data that suggests if I come into Milwaukee, what bump do I get out of Milwaukee? And, you know, we tend to say, okay, you know, Hillary Clinton lost Michigan because she didn't campaign there. So did she lose Pennsylvania because she campaigned too much? There's sort of a causality here. So we actually, in a Romney campaign, we commissioned a poll just because we were sort of curious. Like, you know, we spend all this time and money thinking about where to go and doing all this and running around the country. And like, does it really matter? So we polled before we went into a market, and we polled while we were in that market and after that. And we found that there was, on average, about a 2-point bump. But a week later, that bump was gone. I mean, it was really depressing. And we looked at this data, and then we decided, like, well, what else are we going to do? You know, you kind of have to campaign. So I think that the Biden campaign is being advantaged by this in just a lot of nuts and bolts ways that are below the radar screen. But if you step back and you say, who was the last incumbent president to lose who wasn't in the federal funding system that gave both candidates the same amount of money? And that was Herbert Hoover. And Hoover had sort of a bad year. Now,
a really bad year.
It may be that Trump is having a bad year. But, you know, I felt, just as someone who worked in campaigns, when we abolished sort of one of the last great post-war to get reforms of federal funding for presidential campaigns, that law of unintended consequences kicked in, and we probably abolished a four-year term, because it's just almost impossible for an incumbent not to raise so much more money than a challenger that it will be determinative. Now, we're having an interesting experiment this year. Like, what if there was a pandemic? What if the economy was the worst since the Depression, maybe worse? Can an incumbent still win? It's like, wow, that's an interesting question.
It is an interesting question.
let's play that out, you know, and we'll find out. In a lot of situations, you know, I have a lot of respect for the Biden people because it's incredibly difficult in a campaign to be a front runner, go out, start getting your brains kicked out in the first contest, and not do something stupid to try to reinvent your candidate. I mean, I've been in those rooms, man. It is tremendous hydraulic pressure. Like, we're losing, we have to do something. And the Biden people, and I assume Vice President Biden himself, you know, they decided they were going to win or lose with who Joe Biden was.
Yeah.
Man, that's hard to do. It sounds axiomatic and should be easy. But brother, it is hard. I mean, you're in the third quarter of the Super Bowl and you're behind by 25 points. And you say we're going to keep, you know, stick with our game plan. Man, you got to have a lot of confidence.
The other thing is the Democrats seem to be behaving reasonably well. And I understand it's always annoying to talk about a television show you're watching, but I've been watching this Mrs. America. Have you seen this at all? This is about Phyllis Schlafly and the fight over the ERA. Which sounds like I'm about to go on a digression. But the episode, one of the episodes focuses on the 1972 Democratic Convention. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give spoilers away, but it turns out that Gary Hart and George McGovern are portrayed as the bad guys, weirdly enough. But the chaos, because I remember this so well, the chaos of the Democratic Party, the divisions, their inability to come together, even at the very last moment, their lurch to the left, all of those things. You know, you look back and go, this is dramatically different than that. And they may not even have a convention. But so you do have time for Joe Biden. I think some of the ads they're putting out, I wish they were on television. I wish Michael Bloomberg had gone ahead and said, I'm going to spend $500 million ads.
Maybe he still will.
He ought to, because he spent $1 billion on this campaign.
Yeah, he really should. I think it could be determinative. And it's very difficult. I mean, there's great challenges running against an incumbent. Part of it is, you know, you don't win the nomination till April or May. The guy you're running against has been running a general election campaign since the night that he won the election. So that's a big head start. I mean, if you look at how the Obama campaign smartly ran their campaign, they warehoused a lot of people over at the DNC that was basically just the Obama campaign. And then those people moved over to the Obama campaign at the last minute, so they didn't have to pay them. But it was all dedicated to one purpose. Now, Democrats complain about this a lot because the DNC basically became not an elected Democrats everywhere organization, the way Howard Dean wanted it to be. It became an re-elect Obama campaign.
Yeah, well, as the RNC has become all Trump.
It's all Trump. I mean, to the point where it is a true state. We live in a world, Charlie, I mean, you and I never would have thought this possible, where the RNC endorses Roy Moore and attacks John Bolton. it's like, really?
Well, we live in a world where the president of the United States thinks that George Will is a dummy and retweets Charlie Kirk.
I know.
So it's like, where do we live? Yeah, the RNC, and you know, it's funny because I used to have these discussions with Ryan Priebus about, well, isn't the RNC about the Republican Party as a whole as opposed to the Trump campaign? That feels like a different era. There's no discussion about that at all anymore. None. Zero.
No. I mean, it's just a complete takeover. And listen, win or lose, Trump isn't going to go away. So he's not going to do the, you know, traditional Carter, Bush, Obama thing of being graceful and not enter himself into current events for the next president. He's going to be out there if he loses. And these parties, as you well know, have been completely taken over by Trump people. I mean, even in states like Maryland, Massachusetts, Vermont, where you have wildly popular Republican governors, the parties are run by Trump people. And that's going to continue. And you have these odious Trump children out there that are going to try to run. This isn't going to go away.
No, and I think that's one of the reasons why people have been reluctant to have been reluctant to break with Trump because they know that it's Trump all the way down. It's Trump forever, no matter how far you go on all of this. The one thing that will be different, I was thinking about your comment about the experiment we were running. The one thing that seems, I would think, is a relatively safe prediction is that you're not going to have a lot of complacency on either side, even among Democrats. If Joe Biden goes into Election Day 10 points up in the polls, people are still going to be sweating it because the 2016 experience is just burned into our souls. So, and I think you saw this a little bit in what happened here in Wisconsin, where despite that pandemic election, Democrats turned out in massive numbers, and the way the mail-in voting is changing the nature of our elections is pretty dramatic. And I think this is going to be a real watershed as well. Whatever Donald Trump says about mail-in voting, I mean, it's real, and it's going to be practiced by both parties, and the numbers are going to be just off the charts.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans are elected with mail-in ballots all the time.
Yeah.
And there's actually a very interesting study on this that was done by Knight that goes to non-voters. They did a big post-2016 non-voter study.
Oh, yeah. I saw that.
And I was sort of surprised by it, frankly, because I would have, if you just woke me up in the middle of the night, I would have said non-voters tend to be more lower-income voters, tend to be more minorities who would tend to be more Democratic. But it actually didn't prove to be the case. On whether or not a wall should be built, it was to the good among non-voters. They supported it. So I think that it's like a lot of these things. If Republicans would just embrace the future, I mean, I once worked for a politician that I really loved, a very wise guy, and he said, you know, the best move in politics is to be for the future because it's going to happen anyway.
Hard to argue with that.
It's hard to argue with, you know, embrace it. And instead, you know, we are, in every sense, the party of the past. We're trying to sort of capture this moment that never existed of, you know, great, this make America great again, like, you know, great, let's go back to Jim Crow America. But it's really trying to stop what the country is becoming. And, you know, and all the Stephen Millers in the world, they can, you know, sit there and conjure up all their potions. None of it's going to matter. You're not going to stop.
You know, it is interesting what you say, because I don't know about other people, but I have a hard time envisioning the future. It's like there's this huge wall at the end of this year, and I can't see over it.
Yeah,
I'm having a hard time. I at one time I had a certain confidence and a rather deep. I'm not an optimist. Well, yeah, I guess I'm an optimist, but also, you know, pretty optimistic about the trajectory, a really sense that you kind of knew where the country was going, what the possibilities are. And I think the part of the stress of what we're going through right now is that's kind of blanked out at the moment.
Well, look,
it's like there's a screen over it. So that we're like trapped in this bag of the present.
You know, my thought on this is I think it's always difficult when you're in the middle of a moment to realize sort of the consequences of that moment. But to me, I look at the Republican Party, and for all these reasons we've talked about of what we thought that we believed in, which turned out we believed the opposite, not just that we didn't believe in this stuff, we believed the opposite. I think there's been a complete moral collapse of the Republican Party, unlike any that we've seen certainly in modern American politics and maybe all of politics. The only thing I can think to compare it to is the Communist Party. So, you know, go back and watch Chernobyl and all this. The party just kind of internally collapsed because ultimately what it said it believed and what it did believe was so disparate. So I would predict that we are headed into a period of pretty left government. Eventually, there is a need for a center-right party. But we can't have a center-right party that doesn't have some sort of moral consistency where you can agree what you actually agree upon. And that you can attract younger voters. So right now, I mean, you look at younger voters, Trump's getting killed. And that's like a terrible sign. So I would predict that we're going to head into, you know, Biden, if he wins, will obviously be a transitional figure. And I think we're going to have more left government. I mean, just look at the American healthcare system. We're not going to remain the only country that doesn't have some sort of nationalized healthcare. We're just not. It's a question of how we're going to get there. Well, we're going to get there. I mean, we're not like exempt from the laws of economics and nature. People are going to keep getting sick. People are going to keep needing to go to doctors. People are going to be more and more distressed by being shut out of the system. And we don't exist in an island as much as Trump would like us to.
I tend to agree with you, but also our future is going to be shaped by the fact that clearly we are never going to come to grips with the national debt. That is neither party is going to do
what
that.
What happened to the debt?
What happens to the debt?
I tell you, man, if you ever really, really, want a good reason to drink, go read the 2012 and 2008 Republican Party platform on debt. You just like
I used to live that. I used to live that stuff. So that's part of the future as well. So on that hopeful note, exactly. Stuart. Again, hey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and being so generous. We're still looking at your book. When is it coming out?
It's going to come out August 4th.
Okay.
Which, Knopf's bringing it out. And the most writerly thing in the world would be, I know there's a pandemic and like millions are potentially at risk, but what about my book? I mean, it is going to come out August 4th.
Well, I'm still looking forward to it. The thing about the pandemic is that people are actually home and maybe they have time to read books.
Yeah.
There comes a time when you binged everything you're going to binge, right?
No, I realized that something bizarre was happening. For the first time in my adult life, the stack of New Yorkers by my bed was getting smaller.
Interesting.
That has never happened before. I'm actually reading these things.
I don't think that's ever happened for anyone before. Stuart, again, thank you so much.
All right, buddy. It's great to talk, and I love what you guys are doing. Keep fighting.
All right, and thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.